Ladies and men of the gentle disposition, welcome back once again to Doom Radio, also known as Tango TV, the only Doom podcast with two names. And we are joined today by none other than Jimothy Padlock, who was renowned for his keys. He did the key mod. That was great. James Paddock, on the other hand, alias Jimmy on the forums, is renowned for something else. Many something else's, as it turns out. His music, level design, and cross-forum diplomacy among them. And he's currently doing studies over in Perth. Well, I've already given him the introduction. Let's hear from the man himself. How are you doing, Jimmy?
Hey, Alfonso. I'm doing fine, thanks.
I was going to ask, actually, how your studies were going over there. Previously, I would launch into my interviews asking about history with Doom and all the giant and all that sort of stuff, but I figure we'd try to humanize the guests we're talking to more these days. So tell us what you're up to, what your commitments are in the real world.
All right, IRL Jimmy. Okay. I will be starting my fourth year doing a bachelor degree of a composition and music technology at Edith Cowan University, Western Australia. It's been a lot of fun. It's been very trying at times. I've repeatedly been pushed well outside my comfort zone, that being a nice, you know, cushy bubble where I can just write MIDIs all day long and not have to worry about all the ins and outs of music production and all this just huge universe of the world of composition and, writing music in general for a wider audience. So, you know, it's...
Do any of your friends over at uni, do they make... Are you the only MIDI-zician around on campus?
I'm pretty sure I am the only MIDI guy on campus. That said, I have been exposed to a couple of people who've been... who are willing to like chip tunes and modules and all that sort of stuff, all the old classic walks of music composition.
So there's some common ground somewhere.
Yeah, there's a little bit of overlap. Like people kind of generally know what you're talking about when you're talking about MIDI. It's not like it's a completely outmoded concept.
They don't give you too many raised eyebrows.
they have said, oh yeah, that's pretty cool. That's pretty hipster.
Interesting. Yeah, hipster. Wow.
Okay. Yeah.
I think you actually played Art of the Conjurer, which is one of your famed MIDIs. How did that performance go? And did you attempt to play any other MIDIs or make them more normalized for playing?
Let me think. I'm pretty sure Art of the Conjurer is the biggest one. That said, a lot of my compositions do tend to like start out as MIDI files to begin with, because I just find the process a lot more comfortable to work within than like opening up a digital audio workstation and then like saying, okay, all this choice here, where do I start? So it very much is preferable to me to have a limitation of like that those same 128 instruments that I'm familiar with, and just to be able to write a song that is structurally and melodically all there, rather than dabbling in and out of like how the different ways I can just like generate sounds to begin with. I wholly prefer working within notes, which is actually something that university has been trying to get me to shy away from. Like there's all this avant-garde and noise music kind of stuff that I've been learning about, which has been I've dipped my toe in the water, I guess. There's a couple of ambient-ish works on my SoundCloud page, but for the majority of the time it is, yeah, I do stick to being very much it's very much the G-MIDI kind of
competition. Did you find any opportunities to, or did your teachers want to sit down with you one-on-one and perhaps discuss, Jimmy, your MIDIs are great and all, but we're looking for something a little bit different in our line of studies?
Yeah, I think it's a biannual occurrence at this point where I sit down with the head of composition and he says, yes, maybe you should move away from MIDIs at some point. But I'm basically an immovable object at this point. MIDI's too comfortable for me.
Well, you have had your critics in Doomworld, at least. I know Mrs. Micklethwaite was very keen on seeing you move into, I don't know, any OGG at the very least. I don't know.
Jazz and Essel definitely have been very Both of them have been very supportive of my moves towards digital audio, and like, it is a field that I'm still very much familiarizing myself with and still getting to grips with. It can be stressful and difficult at times, so yeah, I'm very grateful to have their backing, as it were.
Well, it's been 5 years since we did the last interview, actually. I'm astonished, really, that it's been that long. You would assume that we put out podcasts reaching well into the triple figures at that point, but I think it's only between 40 and 50. But nonetheless, still impressive to find that you're actually the first person that we've interviewed a second time on the podcast. So we did manage to get through a few before running the gauntlet again. So in those 5 years, I imagine your style's probably changed a lot, and maybe the your studies have impacted them. So let's talk about you, the musician, and how you've actually advanced, I suppose, in those 5 years. And do you look back at your old work now and disgusted with yourself, or are you reasonably pleased?
Actually, to be honest, my work probably has to be quite old before I can say, nah, I'm no longer happy with that.
Holoferns?
Holoferns. Yeah.
That's actually, only because I noticed the rating system that you put up on your site sometime.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, which
I've going, you've given that actually a solid 2 stars.
Yeah. Yeah, that one was from about, I don't know, 2008 or something. But yeah, I think it was actually based on a module that wasn't, it wasn't my own creation, basically, fully. But actually, was it, I think it was one of the Revolvercate tracks. Which I
won't be able to help you there.
Right, I think it was either Simon Judd or someone similar who wrote those. But it was someone who was present in the Doom community at the time. Oh, it was Scragadelic, right. Actually. It was Scragadelic.
Right, yeah, because I noticed that I don't know why we're talking about Holoferns still, but it's actually full tracks. But it's in the remixes.
Yes.
I downloaded plenty of your MIDIs, and you compartmentalize them very nicely, and so there it is. But yeah. But how has your style actually changed in that you've noticed? Because I'm aware of some of your chief inspirations. Muse is among them, and perhaps you can mm-hmm. list some others.
Yes. I was very big into drum and bass at one point, probably around 2009, 2010, that kind of era. So Pendulum was definitely a very, very big inspiration for me at that time. And just, I was very heavily into just listening to lots of different electronic artists around that same time. So I guess Deadmau5 was another one. Electronica of the time was definitely a big inspiration for me personally back then. Since then, I think I've moved very much into the realm of rock and metal. So Muse definitely started to be like a big inspiration for me around, I guess, 2011 onward, because I just got all their albums and just sort of listened to them nonstop. And I got very big into the metal scene as well with bands like Symphony X, who actually Doom introduced me to Symphony X in the form of Eric Arm's Scythewed.
Wow.
Yeah, Map 23 and Map 26 were definitely... definitely my favorite music selections in that set. And so I've just sort of Googled, I must have looked on the forums or something, because they were Muzz format rather than MIDI format, I think. So I think I may have popped the question and then say, oh, and then it came up, oh, that was a Symphony X track. So, you know, go and look up Symphony X. They're awesome. Massive inspiration for the rest of my life, pretty much. So thanks, Eric Arm.
Wow, influential in many more ways than one, it seems.
Yeah, actually, yeah, he's been a big stylistic influence on my mapping.
On your level design as well. Yeah. Well, when I think of Jimmy MIDIs, in particular the modern variety, well, I suppose also the Jimmy of 3 and 4 years ago, and plus it's the technical aspects to the structuring of your work, I suppose, and the insistency in always trying to slam a solo in there somewhere. That's usually either, if it's not guitar, it's almost certainly saw or square wave or something like that. Do you ever start kicking yourself when you're composing, saying, this is a crutch, I should really start moving away from it, but you can't resist putting this aspect of your...
Yeah. There's definitely an element of that. But at the same time, I'm a sort of big proponent of this kind of style of composition, whereby you're kind of automated during the process, where it's a very kind of automatic process whereby you're just letting stuff flow from you, essentially, and just like, and I forget if there's a specific term for it, but it's definitely one that I've learned during my tenure at university. All those compositional techniques are slowly coming into my style, and I'm sort of learning to just sort of break the mold just a bit with maybe an ambient section or two, or using sound effects from the SFX kit and so on and so forth. So it's not just like I'm using a shit ton of notes anymore. So I think I am slowly trying to break away from that to a certain extent. I think I'm evolving my style into something that's, you know, not quite like wholly built on my own influences personally, of like from a musical perspective, but rather something that just sort of works for me, like that sort of comes from my own kind of conscious mind, I suppose.
I suppose it helps that Doom's music, I suppose the purists might look at the original soundtrack and anything the community puts out and then compare the two, saying, you know, this sounds like Doom music because it's heavy, or it's contrasting with ambient of the sort that Suspense provides, or something like that. Suspense.mid. But we've reached that point in the community now, I think, where there's enough variety in the level design that, likewise, there's enough variety also in the music to provide for it. So you can really just shoot into the breeze anywhere it lands. There'll be a map that could be a go cap in hand with that design. So that, I suppose, gives you a lot of freedom to work with, right?
Yeah, definitely. The level design as of the last 5 years or so has really sort of come into this sort of giant, just behemoth kind of field of creativity. There's a lot of very, very talented mappers out there right now, like, you know, Skillsaw, Ribix, Dobu.
Absolutely. We've moved away from tech bases to the point where, why are we still making tech bases and the like, and why can't we move away from that? So I suppose, I know, even though I don't consider myself to be a very influential musician at all in the community, but I know I breathed a sort of sigh of relief when I realized that I could basically make anything I want. And the level designers were starting to question themselves in this way. Over the last year and a half, 2 years, actually, you've been putting together four, I think it is, 30 in 30
yes.
music packs. Now, could you tell us what those are and why you decided to do those? And please also don't tell us about the MIDI battles that you won. This is me.
Well, I think it started during a... it would have been Tango TV mapping, the TTV Zone stuff.
That long ago, wow.
Yeah, like 2013. I think the very first one that I did was Flatulence Protocol. .mid.
Which, that was my fault, wasn't it?
Yes, the name was your fault, at least. But I just sort of decided it might have been either you or Tarnsman on the call at the time said, "I bet Jimmy can't make a MIDI for this map in the resource building time."
Oh, good grief! That was a mistake.
It was like, I think I had 10 minutes to write it, and so I did, and I just came up with a guitar riff that was just sort of in my mind at the time, and I added a saw wave and a koto to it, and then I had a sort of track at the end of it, and then that track was featured in Valiant, strangely, so that's, I think, very much the genesis of it, I discovered that, you know, actually it's very possible to write stuff very quickly, with MIDI in particular, because it's just a set of instructions for the computer, really. It's not like you have to record anything directly in with a real instrument. That's obviously possible, and I do that with my MIDI keyboard and such. But because you can just paint notes in and the computer just does what you like, it's entirely possible to create something very, very quickly with MIDI, I feel, which it might not be with any other medium aside from maybe like NES sound chip stuff, or, you know, Sega Genesis stuff, or chip change stuff, any all that sort of stuff, where it's a very limited palette of sound. So 30 and 30 came about because I just sort of found the practice kind of addictive, and a very good way to usher out that creativity in a very productive way. And certainly you and Jazz and I think Stewboy as well, to an extent, helped out with contributing to making the process that much more fun by introducing that sort of that multiplayer aspect to it,
it was loads of fun stuff. Being defeated soundly over many months. Actually, I mean, that became almost the sort of standard for you for about 2 years. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm saying that, I mean, because you're always putting out music material, but I think the vast majority were MIDIs as part of that 30 and 30. So you must have been very attracted to that model. And in some ways, I suppose this could function as a segue into mapping, because likewise, there's an addiction to speed there as well, mapping within certain time restraints. But we'll get onto the mapping later. But certainly on the music front, you do like mapping. Composing within those restraints. Is there something cathartic about it, or do you get a hit from that? What's going on there?
I think it's the speed element helps me kind of overcome any personal doubts that I have during the composition process, because there's usually quite a significant lull. If I'm starting out a track with like a very sort of basic idea in my head, then there's usually a point where I have to sort of play that idea back a few times to see what kind of comes out from that. So what should logically follow from that sequence of notes, or from that drum roll, or whatever. So would it be a bass guitar or some sort of synth? What's the track actually going to be, essentially, that the moment that kind of defines the rest of the track, as it were, from those first few bars that I write in? So that area in particular, I think I gave a presentation on this at uni actually, and I called that particular area like the pit of doom or something, which is
good grief,
which is a lull of that kind of that willingness to go. And I think a lot of creative minds actually kind of stumble into the same block. It's the point at which you think, okay, well, I've done something, now what? And then for a lot of people, that's the point where they give up, I think. Even if it's like something that's, you know, only taken like a couple of minutes to put down, it's like, right, where do I go from here? And it's, you know, it's a huge obstacle for people who, you know, have the time to do it, but perhaps not like the exact amount of creative energy to pull off something in a short span of time. So with speed writing or speed composing, whatever you want to call it, that kind of lifts that inability to write by kind of forcing you to. I feel it's a way of saying, okay, well, you've only got 30 minutes. You might as well just sort of run with this in whatever direction your brain kind of takes it. So it helps me to overcome any kind of stress or doubt I have in the moment by saying, okay, well, just, you know, it doesn't really matter if it doesn't sound right at first listen, just get some more notes down and see what comes of it, basically.
Is this a process that you would recommend to new musicians? And I suppose you could answer at the same time how long from memory it took you to compose those initial tracks. I know myself, when I was working on tracks of mine that shall not be mentioned here, but I it's actually, I think, 2 months between the first and second, and I may have spent in excess of 2 or 3 days spitting out a 2-minute track or something, and I still haven't sped up that much. Certainly I'm much more productive, but do you think maybe the speed method is something more to stimulate those who have already some basis of knowledge in composing for MIDI, I suppose. So for people such as yourself, or is this something that you would recommend for budding musicians, like Gustavo, for example, for him to work within time restraints like this?
Possibly. It might require quite a bit of knowledge on, you know, music theory and a little bit of dabbling in and out of, like, you know, of actual music that you listen to, i.e. like studying the harmony and the melody in depth just a little bit to see going on under the scenes.
Well, I don't have any of that. I think there's a reason why I think that explains quite a lot.
Well, when I say that, it's more a case of like, sometimes I remember like a chord progression or something, right, or like, okay, I'll listen, yeah, I'll hear a couple of notes in my head from a song that sort of sounds familiar to what I'm currently working on.
So it's not having the textbook open while you compose.
No, not right. At all. No. But I would probably say that you should probably bank on a little bit of pre-knowledge before you go headlong into this speed composing method, because it can... And it still does. It can backfire. You can end up with something like "You're not supposed to be here, Dotmin." So you can end up with something that's a bit of a mess. But if it's only like half an hour, then, you know, it's only half an hour that you've potentially spent not at your prime, basically. And I wouldn't see the experience as negative. I would just see it as a period in which you've basically put your all into something creative, and, you know, on this occasion, it just hasn't happened to come together into a coherent product. So I would say beginning musicians, maybe like Gustavo, maybe like Joe Ilya, etc. Maybe give it a crack, see if it's right for you. It's probably not for everybody. Maybe some seasoned musicians will scoff at the idea. I don't know, but working within half an hour exactly is typically, I think, a very good window to pressure you, but also to give you just a little bit of creative freedom to just sort of rough out the edges on any ideas that you have that kind of like aren't gripping you at first. Because once you get past that pit of doom barrier, it's like you have, you know, the rest of the track basically just sort of comes into its own. And then half an hour later, you have a finished product. And, you know, whether that's objectively a good finished product is pretty much immaterial. But it's half an hour that you've spent doing something good and productive, I feel. So
I think you could take the pit of doom to a TED talk. I think I'd roll with that. Yeah. I mean, I agree wholeheartedly that the creative process is very particular to every person, and I mean, I went through 50 such MIDIs, mostly alongside you, and I'm quite confident coming out the 50th. I mean, I'm probably only satisfied with about 10, maybe 15% of them. And those are the ones that not all of those necessarily loop. I didn't actually go to the effort at the end to piece them together because I didn't want to see them ever again or hear them. But I'm still glad, very glad, to have done it, because I discovered much more about myself as a musician, and likewise as a mapper, because I have difficulty sticking to time restraints there. But more on that later. Let's talk a little bit about MIDI commissions, because this is, to my knowledge, first of all, what is it in your case? Just to mention that it's, I think, you're the first musician in the community to do something like this. So just talk us through what that is and what your method is, I suppose.
Well, it's a little bit of a hard question for me to answer, but I'll do my best. It's basically me saying, I've served as this, you know, community musician for, well, upwards of 10 years now. And the idea is that, you know, it's, I'm sort of,
starving artist.
Perhaps, yeah, it's really an experiment more than anything else, I suppose. It's just seeing, you know, how the community kind of receives and perceives my work, I suppose. Whether they see that to be something that, you know, they're willing to spend money on, and if they do, it's really kind of very much a bonus. I am still doing a little bit of MIDI work on the side as a freebie kind of dealie, but
that's just a marketing stunt, isn't it? That's just to rein them in.
Well, I mean, there's one thing that I have that I'm still working on, which is the soundtrack to Mechadon's Supplice project. which I actually started doing something towards at the very beginning of the year, which was I aimed to do a kind of one track per day thing, as I did with the fourth 30 and 30 installment. And it didn't quite pan out as I wanted. I was just feeling a little bit low on inspiration for whatever reason, which was a little bit ridiculous given that everybody was just sort of throwing music my way throughout the process. I think I probably had a bit too much at the end of it, but so I think once I'm done with the Supply soundtrack, I will probably actually step away from MIDI just a little bit and focus more on my university studies, if they're still ongoing at the time, that is, and really just becoming the professional musician I need to be. The commissions thing is, I guess, a sort of practice for real world transactions wherein I'm actually, you know, giving away my creative ability for a set fee. It hasn't accrued a great deal of feedback one way or the other, but from what I can tell, people, you know, if they know me and if they know my music, then they are willing to part with a small sum just to commission something very special from me.
Well,
which is nice.
I won't do the disservice of asking just how much that small sum is. That'd be a very rude question. But could you give us some ideas as to the sort of things that you've already accomplished with your commissions? How many people have approached you, and are they satisfied customers?
I do have a list of about, I think it's four. Let me just pull it up quickly. Yeah, it's four. So, Marnet Mar, aka Stapler, asked me for something.
Ah, Staples, yeah.
for a project. I don't know whether I'm supposed to talk about it, but Vorpal commissioned me for a track for his Black Label Alien Vendetta map, and Dobu and King Dime have also especially commissioned me something. In the case of Dime, it was actually a track for Miasma, which you guys talked about on the Cacords.
I was about to mention that some it's not all that surprising that Dime would step forward to help you out there, because he's obviously trying to make something of a living, my understanding, out of his streaming endeavors. So he probably, he's probably trying to help gain traction in that department. And I suppose this also lends in some way to a tangentially related point, because there's been some discussion around the community at the moment with regards to Patreons and them becoming standardized in the community. So I was wondering if you have an opinion on that. We'd have to delve into relationships of certain individuals and their patrons. I know there's a lot of hoopla surrounding Sergeant Mark, for example, but just generally speaking, do you think that's a healthy practice? I was having a discussion with Tarnsman about this earlier, and he's a staunch capitalist, and he didn't care one way or the other. He thought if you can make money, then all the more power to you. But the community to this point has sort of operated exceptionally well on just the power of goodwill, and the understanding that, you know, others will be there to reciprocate, and so that sort of ecosystem thrives like that. Do you think? I suppose in some way this is a question I could ask of your MIDI commissions as well, although that's probably less of an issue because it's a much smaller subset of the community. But with regards to patrons, do you think they can have a negative impact, or do you think that's something that we should encourage?
Yeah, for some reason, Patreon hasn't been one thing that I've particularly delved into. But if I were to just make some sort of semi-educated observation of it, it really is just a case of people wanting to take their creation of, you know, Doom-related media probably to the next level. Certainly, I would be very interested if someone like Skillsaw or Essel put up a Patreon, whereby, you know, they were either, like, working on something that was like, you know, big, like, I don't know, Ancient Aliens 2, for example, that you know, sucked up a whole lot of time and resources. And I would definitely be behind supporting something like that. I'm just having a quick look at Sergeant Mark IV's page at the moment. He says apparently he wants $500 a month to treat Doom like a full-time job. And, you know, that's not asking terribly much in the grand scheme of things, but...
Well, people are always willing to part with their money, I've discovered, for all sorts of things. And I wouldn't... this isn't a preempter or a taster, I suppose, and asking whether or not Doom Radio should be moving in that direction. We're not, people. Don't worry about that. This is all free for now. Yeah. In that discussion with Tarnsman on stream, I came to realize, because he bumped the question right back at me, saying, didn't word it as a question, but I felt obliged to answer. You know, I wouldn't like to do it full time, but if I did, I would expect that I would have a portfolio of work behind me so that people were aware of what they were getting, and so I wouldn't feel under pressure to really change my approach in order to cater to a larger audience. Because it's a very niche interest anyway. So the people that be interested in offering you some support financially wouldn't really have an impact on your creative process, and so you wouldn't feel that you had to stop looking at it as a hobby and start looking at it as a job. So in that sense, I agree. I don't think it is at all a bad thing for the community. The question is whether an audience gets so large, the community expands to such a size that people feel pressured to pander to some preferable style of level design. You can call it the AAA version of level design versus whatever the rest of the community is putting out. So ultimately, I think it's a grand thing. But the interview isn't about me. Let's move on to mapping now. And in some ways, this will be related to... it all boils down to creativity. So to your talk on music and the like. So just as your music's changed over the last 5 years in the ways that you've mentioned, how's your mapping changed? And I'm thinking here about stuff like unorthogon. You did that whole experiment. You were trying to shape your approach to mapping in that way. Take us through the journey of the last 5 years.
I might be clutching at straws here, but it might kind of extend back to 2012, when I think I was part of the Doom 2 The Way It Did project.
Oh, wow. And flattering.
Asked to simplify my approach in order to do an American McGee-style map 14 flooded library. So I guess I'm not particularly pleased with the map itself, if I'm honest. It's kind of more like a Jimmy map than a McGee map. But I think I've definitely found an affinity for simplifying my approach when it comes to mapping. Not creating like huge like connected squares that are just sort of... there's a lot of that in Genesis where... most of the map is based around orthogonal constructs, and the detail comes from, you know, sanding off the edges and like adding like little finicky details in the middle, and it sort of becomes a bit of a kind of a rectangular bobbiness. So I think my recent approach with those unorthogonal maps has been very much to create something that caters a little bit to the classic Doom formula, where, you know, the shapeliness of a room isn't necessarily striving for realism, where, you know, the abstract constructs that you can create like benefit the gameplay and, you know, add character to the map rather than trying to simulate like a real life experience.
Does that mean that we're never going to see a Highway of Destruction too?
Probably one of my favorite maps in Genesis as well. But the reason that it's, I think, a bit unlike all of those other maps in Genesis, just from a gameplay standpoint, the fact that it's, you know, run and gun and fast action gameplay and all that sort of stuff.
Highly conceptual, yeah.
Yeah. So with my kind of like unorthogonal style, I'm certainly trying to shake up my own formula and like it, my kind of like method of exploring creativity is very much to sort of keep exploring what I can do and just to keep pushing and challenging myself in various ways. And certainly the unorthogonal style, which I don't know if I've actually released anything aside from that unorthogonal map in Mayhem 13, was it? I think, or Mayhem 14. 14, yeah, that's about right. And the birthday map for Jazz Nickel, Funky Metal, which I released a couple of years ago. So there's a couple more still in the works in the form of a little project that me and Primeval are working on called Iconoclast. So I'm unsure whether that project will be released soon, but because we've both got stuff going on. I've got my studies, he's got work and stuff, I think. But we are trying to create something a little bit unique with that one. I'm mapping in Boom, he's mapping in C-Doom, and we're adding little modern touches with a couple of new weapons and enemies and such. And like basically the project will be a little bit old school, but it'll have all those little Z-Doomy nuances to it, essentially. But very much for my own mapping during creating things for that project. I think I may have streamed a couple, actually. Yeah, lots of orthogonal stuff going on there. A lot of homages to the classic Doom formula with abstract shapeliness and not paying so much mind to making it seem like a place, like still like trying to create a sense of setting and atmosphere, but in a way that was very effective, you know, back in the day, back in 93.
You had a lot of your start was rooted in Skulltag way back when. I think you did a lot of deathmatch material for that, both in music and mapping camp, I think. And so you've never really been, as far as I can remember, attached to vanilla. It's always been Boom Plus up with the advanced ports. And in particular, recently, of course, with Adventures of Square. I'm wondering if your experience with that, and we'll talk about the project later, but if your mapping experience with that has encouraged you in more conventional Doom circles to try and integrate UDMF features or something. I'm thinking in particular here of recent works like Tungsten or Mercury Rain, I think it was called.
In the case of Mercury Rain, certainly I was trying to create something memorable and unique, I think, to really explore the setting aspect of my maps, because sometimes you can just throw some textures together and it doesn't form an entirely coherent setting or place. I find that with a few of the speed maps that even I've made and
they feel quite placeless.
Yeah, just
lacking the sort of well-rounded definition. But one of the things that I noticed people praising, it might have just been the one, but I swear there may be many, is they really like just the simple rain effect that you put in Mercury Rain. But rain is always featured in a number of Seed New maps, so I think it was just the overall simplicity in concept of the map, just with one overriding element that made it stick out in particular. So what really impresses me is this sort of marriage of advanced features with very very grounded elements to the gameplay that a lot of old heads can recognize in the game. So something like Mercury Rain plays very classically, but it's got plenty of new additions and it all works together seamlessly. It's I think Terma has described it, not Mercury Rain, but that sort of play as sort of Doom Plus. I may be misquoting, but I think we can see where it's coming from there.
All right, yeah. I think it was very much my intention to make basically a Jimmy map, just one that kind of pulls from my inspiration in working with Boom, and I think my very few outings with Vanilla. I think Doom 2 the way it did and Back to Saturn X have been my only ones so far.
Wow.
But yeah, that essential core gameplay that, you know, that is possible in Boom with just a few minor Z-Doom enhancements is always has to me always felt like there's a bit of a dearth in the community of that kind of stuff, where the Z-Doom features are not sort of up front and in your face, and the level design may suffer as a result, basically, from that. So yeah, with Mercury Rain, it was very much I'll just make a map and then just sort of see if I can pretty it up. But it was a very kind of early decision for me to add the rain to it, and certainly I didn't want it to be a pain in the ass to actually add to the map. So the simplicity approach was definitely something I went with. In fact, I think I actually, I did very much borrow the effect from Realm 667, but made a lot of changes to it just to make it a little less painful to add to the map. So there were moments where like rain was kind of like splashing, like it had the animation, the raindrops had the splashing animation, but they were getting caught on walls and stuff, and it was just looking really off and bad. And like this is, and I was just saying to myself, this is what it would look like if it was a Zedum map that was basically trying too hard, essentially. So you know, where you know there's a lack of care taken into like integrating those extra little details in a way that's pretty much seamless with the core gameplay of Doom, like in terms of mapping. So that's where I think I was able to simplify the rain to a degree to make it just sort of a little bit subtle but not in your face, basically.
Bonus piece of trivia. To my recollection, Jimmy's favorite sound in the world is rain on rooftops. Am I correct?
Just the sound of rain and the smell of rain, even. I mean, yeah, it's. I think the word is pluviophile.
Wow. Okay. Well, now we know you're obsessed because there's no way anyone else would know that word. So, one common thread through both your music and your level design. As we discussed, is the willingness to move fast, and is, I suppose, the same principle applies to your mapping, right? Because particularly with Joy of Mapping, which you describe not as being a speed mapping. In fact, I don't think you ever used the word in affiliation with that project, but nonetheless, there is not a time limit, but the mappers are encouraged to accomplish certain tasks within a certain time. Again, is the attraction to mapping at speed for your levels, is that the same as it is for music? Is there a difference there? And what's the attraction?
Speed, yeah. I think it just boils down to the simple fact that getting things done fast just allows you to get stuff done faster. A lot of people do fall into that trap where they just sort of become uncertain of themselves, especially if they're beginner mappers. They see what the Zedum engine, for example, is capable of,
and
like they see
get carried away. That's right.
They get straight into the UDMF config file. They open up a blank map in Doom Builder, and then they just sort of stare at it for 10 minutes, and then close Doom Builder. So, I think. Let me think. Joy of Mapping, I think, started out basically because I was seeing a lot of this around, a lot of this kind of notion that mapping was a difficult practice to pick up. That there was a lot of choice in the matter, that there was that it was just difficult for like new people on the scene to really get into and to get involved with, definitely. So yeah, and a couple of like different circles of friends of mine, I was finding the people were sort of viewing mapping as this sort of big impossible kind of notion that's only left to the professionals,
like
really.
Arcane knowledge that was only accessible to the old heads.
Yeah, exactly. So Joy of Mapping really is just a case of me wanting to prove to people that, you know, basically anyone can make a map. Like if you can draw shapes on a grid, then you're halfway there, basically. And people do struggle with just that phase of it, I think. Hearing the mapping advice from the horse's mouth, as it were, might encourage people to think actually that mapping isn't that difficult, and that if you just apply a few sane rules and just bear a couple of things in mind, like mapping layout, just a few minor things like, you know, Romero's golden rules and such, that really do stick in the mind, that they're not that difficult.
Bearing in mind that Romero actually broke half of his rules after he set them out, but yes, I agree that they're good ones to follow.
Rules are made to be broken, and certainly Joy of Mapping isn't all about rules as such. I'm trying to make it quite stringent in terms of the time limit, just so that people don't get completely burnt out with the process or get bogged down in stuff like adding scripting and light effects and fog effects to their maps and stuff. That's not as such what Droid Mapping was meant to be about. It's more a case of let's just make maps and make them fast.
I think it's a very
a bunch of fun while we do it.
Yeah, I think it's a very important project to pursue, particularly now where the top end material that are making waves outside a little bubble in Doomworld and ZDF are the ones that look absolutely staggering and that they don't just play well. So some mappers might, budding mappers might feel overawed.
On a
few occasions where I've jumped over to VR, for example, on 4chan, I've noted a lot of comments saying, "Oh well, time to quit mapping if I can way I can make up to that standard or something."
And, that's very much a mindset that a lot of amateur people kind of run into, where it's like, "Oh, that's already being done really well. What could I possibly contribute to the community?" I think for a long time I've tried to subvert that mindset. Certainly, it can be intimidating to see what some people can do very easily, and certainly I'm completely baffled by Mechadon and Skill Source mapping abilities. I keep going on about Skill Source.
Yeah, was Mechadon's counterattack material supposed to be him working fast? Was that his version of a speed map? I think actually took 58 minutes to complete the first level.
I think that is Mechadon working fast. Yes. Velopax is, I'm pretty sure, was meant to be a speed map set. Which is just sort of ballooned.
That's hilarious.
And that was meant to be a warm-up for Supplies. So expect Supplies in about 2050, I suppose. that's a bit mean. But yeah, I think why I peddle speed as a great way to pick up mapping is so that, people actually know what they're capable of doing in a short span of time, because it comes back to this notion of creativity as a kind of automative process where you don't really think about it. You just sort of apply yourself to the process and just sort of see what comes out of the end.
So it's much like greasing the gears and then sending them out into the real world to make real maps. Oh no. Actually, that was the question I was going to ask you next. I thought you might find it interesting, because so much of your work has been framed by this sort of approach. You haven't sat down outside of some of your maps for, say, Square, which are quite behemoth in size. A lot of the works you've done, if you haven't been dwelling on for too long and not actually working on it, when you're sitting down and doing it, they get done within a pretty fast, pretty small time frame. So if someone was interested in the works of James Paddock and they asked a layman, to point him in the direction, him or her in the direction of the most impressive work, or what that person would consider to be the defining piece, would you rather they point to something like Genesis or Jiffy Bag, or what do you consider to be the most your defining piece of work so far?
That's a very good question. I think Adventures of Square, possibly, just in terms of what I kind of do creatively, as when I'm doing everything, essentially, when I'm doing the music and the art and the level design and a little bit of sounds and voices and stuff. So Adventures of Square is very much a passion project for me personally. I think I've had it, well, I've had various versions of it in mind, with intent to realize them fully. Going on maybe 15 years now. It's been
That long. And it was Ben's idea originally. I mean, we'll get to the, I guess we could talk about the origins now, but we'll get to the development of it later. But so you'd point people in the direction of Adventures of Square, but so much of your work is...
I think I might go for Genesis if they wanted to see my boom mapping side, or Jiffy Bag if they wanted to see that side, as my modern practices have just vaguely shaped it, because all of Jiffy Bag is speed maps, basically.
You would put your speed mapping efforts on par with everything else. It's just a matter of what people are looking for.
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah, if they're looking for short maps by me, then go to Jiffy Bag. If they want long maps done under pretty much the same kind of creative approach, then yeah, they would go to, I would say, point them to Genesis, and because that's that was a project I worked pretty hard on with intent to speed map all the maps, but that kind of didn't pan out exactly. Like, there's always going to be an element of, there usually is anyway, an element of a sort of obstacle, an amount of challenge that you run into when you undertake anything like tremendous, like a one man megawatt or
yes,
or a one track a day challenge, as I did for 1334. So there's always going to be just a little bit of there's a few barriers to overcome there, but for the most part, I think those three projects probably sum up my identity as a doomer, I would say.
Until Sublice is released, and then you'd point people in that direction, I'm guessing.
Yeah, if I do any maps for that, I might, I don't know.
Oh, I thought you were involved in more than just the music side. Okay, that's...
I think it's on the cards, but the mapping phase has yet to start, so yeah, we'll see what comes about when that happens.
I think the argument that that some people might make is that certainly I was, or am, I'm still mulling it over, a proponent of this, in saying that when you want to showcase your own work, you want to show yourself at your best. And you say as much with something like Adventures of Square. I think some people might say when they look at the speed maps, well, that's just not me being given, by definition, the time to really flourish and show what I'm capable of at my absolute heights. But you would say that's really defined you in a way, that approach to mapping. So it would be a more honest approach to say this is where you really should be looking, and that's me as a level designer, that's my identity, working at right speed and getting the results that way.
Pretty much, yeah. I think most of my mapping work definitely has come from pretty much forcing myself to do work. That might sound a bit odd, but
no, not at all.
Well, yeah, I definitely struggled a lot initially to create complete maps. I would always start with just a germ of an idea. I would always start with the starting room, and then barely anything after that. This is quite a few years back now, though. So back when I was doing Genesis, that was very much an exercise to try and break myself out of that mold, out of that inability to create something full and like a map, like a full product, basically. So I adopted kind of a speed mapping approach with that. It wasn't like a do one thing a day, but it was find the inspiration from somewhere, maybe like write a layout out on a piece of paper or something, and then come back to it when you have, you know, the energy and the verb to do it. And then go at it, basically. Have at it. So I think that web still took me about 11 months or maybe 13 months to complete totally. But I was busy with studies at the time and stuff. So yeah,
actually that might serve as a pretty good segue, because we were going to get into project leadership and other sorts of community involvement straight after this. Okay. But this lends quite nicely to the further discussions in the creativity department, particularly with finding motivation and this being a sort of solution to that, and also touching upon whether it feels more like work than it does a hobby sometimes, particularly, you know, when you have so many commitments. I know you're involved both here on Doomworld and over on ZDF, and trying to bridge the gap in some way. That's one of the things I really like about Joy of Mapping, is that ZDF is known probably more so for its putting out its mods than really collaborating on community works like that, like for mapping. Do you ever feel that maybe you part of some of the processes you take are there because you're just trying to get stuff out of the way so you can get back to doing things that you other corners of personal projects you might be working on that you really want to work on, and treat it more like a hobby than it does like work? Does it sometimes weigh you down, I guess?
I wouldn't say that. Well, the mapping side, I find it's a method of creativity that doesn't exactly kind of stifle me very much. There's always an element of freedom to it, because you can really just make anything into. So if you don't feel like creating like a short tech based speed map, one day you can instead do like a spacey kind of weird gothic void kind of map instead. So it really is totally up to the mapper to kind of fuel their creativity in a way that, you know, that helps them. So I think I do treat Doom as a hobby, but like very, very passionately, because I think at one point in my life I had the Adventures of Square and my university studies happening concurrently, but I was placing the exact amount of importance on both of them. Basically because...
I hope none of your teachers are listening.
Well, I was showing off Square at university, so...
might tie back. Be careful.
Well, yeah. I don't tire of Doom. It's basically... Because I grew up with it, I started making maps from a very early age. I did move on to stuff like Duke Nukem 3D mapping and then StarCraft mapping even. But yeah, Doom just has always been the funnest thing that I think I've been able to come back to and just enjoy repeatedly. And certainly the community at large just today is just so just effervescent with creativity. It's just froths and bubbles. it's just a beautiful place to be if you're just looking for creativity and inspiration.
Well, I think I can quote you on that. Effervescence, yeah. And all. Certainly I think that one of the best ways of getting around that problem that some people might have if feeling too much like work is that you can go wrong in Doom mapping and it can turn out right. I mean, you can take a wrong turn, you can make something that you didn't think you wanted, really, because it's just there are so many ways to realize something that plays well. And I suppose also that ties in nicely to your method of having discipline in your mapping in that way. It's always productive.
Never delete anything, no matter.
Okay. Actually, well, ironically, I did delete the podcast. I lost it. I think I lost it. I can't remember. It's one of those two. I think they're both bad, those outcomes, anyway.
Pretty much, yeah. If you're going for creativity, then destruction isn't the way to do it, I feel.
God, I would contest that still, but that's a discussion again for another time. Mm-hmm. So you've been leading up a few projects. Adventures of Square is obviously a big one. More recently, as in a couple of days ago, you started the third MIDI pack project, this one for Rebirth, the previous two. That's Vader's Rebirth from 2003?
I think it was 2003.
Right, yeah. And your experience in governing those projects, and I wasn't around for the first one, or rather I was, but I didn't take part. But the second one, I know, there was a huge burst in the first month. I think we actually managed to get 2/3 of the entire thing done and then just dropped off for about 11 months, and it required just a burst, a revival, and really just a few heads and hands working on the project to really finish it off. And I sympathize with Doom 2 the way it did as well. We had pages and pages and the forums filling up and into the first week or two, and then likewise that took almost an entire extra year to get. So what's happening there? I mean, is it a problem with the framing the project to begin with, or is it a problem with the community? And just maybe talk about if you want to lead into Square as well and motivation issues and trying to hold a team together. I think that's a good time to do it.
Yeah, I guess I could say a lot, but I wouldn't pin the blame solely on the community. I think, you know, certainly project management has been a thing that I guess I'm still getting to grips with, in a sense. Having spearheaded those three MIDI pack projects, it's certainly something I'm getting used to. But I know that I, as a project leader, could have quite a bit more focus on specific projects. And certainly with regards to like stuff like deadlines, I don't really impose deadlines on myself if I absolutely need, unless I absolutely have to. So there's a little bit of, my way of working possibly requiring just a little bit of a booster in terms of focus when it comes to basically herding a bunch of people in order to create the content that is necessary to put a project like the MIDI pack projects together or Adventures of Square. I think I've observed this pretty recently, actually. My role as leader tends to be more kind of, I'm sort of a guiding voice rather than saying, okay, everybody, here's what I want you all to do. Have it done by X time, basically. Certainly with Joy of Mapping, I try and put the creative control onto the mappers, which is why I let people like map in whatever format they choose or use whatever resources they would like, let them pick, or you know, the music and stuff. So I enjoy being able to guide a bunch of people in order to create a project, but it's not so much me telling them what needs to be done. Like someone like Essel and Tarnsman, I think possibly to an extent would definitely have a lot to say specifically to each participant in a project to say, okay, this is what you've got to do to get your product up to par. But I suppose with me, it's just a case of, hey, do you have something that you can offer? Well, you know, join the crew, basically. You know, you're welcome here, like whatever kind of walk of life you're from, basically. That said, I do, you know, I am still kind of a stickler for quality, and I'll try and get every single submission up to par as best I can. With regards to the MIDI pack projects anyway, with Joy of Mapping, I'm not particularly fussed if the maps are good or bad. It's really just an outing of seeing what people can do in the time constraints with the ability that they have, whether that's, you know, great or small.
Well, I know there's one particular mapper that you must have a limit, because there was one guy who submitted a map for Joy Mapping that you...
I won't say anything.
We'll keep you guessing. And him, and them, or her. Anyway, God, that's cruel. Jeez, no. It's okay, really. We'll get there in the end. But, yeah, I mean, it's clearly not for lack of interest, otherwise we wouldn't be getting such bursts at the start, only for it to drop off. And it's difficult to balance, knowing that we have to respect the fact that it's a hobby and that people have free time. It's not as long as though any of this is monetized. So I suppose the questions as to where we can keep things going, I mean, I certainly wouldn't have so much of an issue with it if it was just moving along at a slow pace, yes, but if it was constant, it's the stop starting that I think is an area that we can somehow overcome, if only we had better methods for it, I suppose. Do you think that maybe in using the forums, it's a little bit of an outdated approach? I know certainly it's better from way back when compared to when they were doing communicating via email. Still managing to get two Memento Moris out in the same year, so fair plays to them. But we have, we're talking on Discord now, for example, our private server, and IRC has been around forever. But I mean, if that was going to be so effective in bringing teams together, then that effect has already come and gone. Is there a better method that we could use, using software, for example, that for these communities to be, these community projects to come together? Because Discord is something where you almost automatically log on if you want to connect to the outside world, and that simply just puts you in the frame of discussion. It's so easy to connect, whereas with the forum, you have to go to the effort of typing everything out, making a post, explaining why you haven't been. So maybe there's a way to sort of bump up the speed a little bit with Discord. Would you agree?
Possibly. I'm definitely very keen on Discord. I'm very since I was introduced to it last year only, so it's I wouldn't say that I'm new to it, but it's definitely something that has proven to be very effective in terms of communicating with large groups of people. It's got a lot of capabilities like the forums and like IRC, but it kind of has them all in one very very neat little package. So, you know, you can embed files and, you know, so animated GIFs all show up properly and stuff like that. Videos even, video thumbnails and stuff. So it's got the compactness of like Skype and IRC and stuff like that. And of course the voice-to-voice communications, like abilities like, you know, TeamSpeak, Mumble, that kind of stuff. But it's also got, you know, the immediacy of an IRC channel and all the modern capabilities that I feel a forum should have. So I don't want to say that Discord will totally surpass the forums, because obviously the forums are still being visited very regularly on a daily basis. Doomworld is definitely, and of course, right. Ling is working on a large forum software update, so that's going to be interesting to witness, actually. It'll be cool to see what comes out of that. Because I think at that point, the community will be changing quite a bit, but not radically. It won't be like, you know, it's not like, I don't think like there'll be a huge swath of new blood. It'll be more like people who maybe weren't so keen on the idea of forums will start using the forums, and people who prefer to stick to IRC channels and Discord will do the same. So I think it's always best to just keep your options open with the community.
Yeah.
To have that ability to communicate on whatever ground is most familiar to, you know, the average consumer, basically.
Mm. If you look at the really old posts on Doomworld versus the ones that are put out today, by new members and old alike, there seems to be a trend moving from almost IRC-like commentary in 2-3 sentences to Demon of the Well type posts that scroll on for ages. And I think that's because people generally recognize that the forums have their place. You know, they can't really ever be supplanted. Whereas something like IRC or something like Discord will always provide that immediate feedback. So I think there's a happy marriage there that we can find will be useful going forward for managing projects. One thing I was really, really pleased to see when I was helping tutor the Joy of Mapping session was people always just punching in screenshots of their work in process, because it's so easy to do there. And
it really is, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a fluidity there that we've never really had access to before, and it enables us to connect a lot more. So they should really be paying us for all this talk that we're doing at the moment. So I would recommend that everyone make the jump. Do you want to plug your channel, Joy of Mapping channel? If any prospective mappers are out listening to this?
I have a Discord for the Joy of Mapping, which I post in every thread related to the Joy of Mapping that I post on the forums. That is Doomworld and Xenon forums. So I can't give you the address because it's just a bunch of numbers and letters.
Right, but, yeah.
It's easy to join. You just click the link and it takes you to the website. And then from the website, you can download the desktop app if you like, but you can just totally access the channel from the web as well. So, yeah, that's actually one of the advantages of it, I think, the fact that it's so immediate, just in terms of logging in and getting straight down into it.
So let's talk a bit about, since we've been through Joy of Mapping in quite a bit of detail, which is good, Adventures of Square in particularly how it's going, because Tarnsman informs me, although he corrected himself, saying you guys weren't actually as close as you wanted to be to an episode to release, but you're getting there, and I think you're going to be releasing it separately now. And for anyone who doesn't know, you might as well talk a little bit about what Adventures of Square is, just in brief.
Okay. So Adventures of Square is a total conversion for Z-Doom. Pretty much all the art, and it's ballooned into a big kind of team-based project, but the original demo of it that I released back in 2013 was all my art, sounds that I'd picked out. It was very much me doing my own thing in the Doom engine, basically, so just me playing around with stuff. And since then, it's grown into this just big, giant total conversion project. It's being released episodically, so episode 2 will be released. Well, I can't give a guaranteed answer to that, but really hoping for this year. Just really hoping. a lot of it is on me because I'm very much the creative director of the project still. Matt Tropiano has been a big help on managing the project. I've got some great mappers on board, like Zaza and Tarnsman. folks like that. Yeah, just it's really kind of like, in many ways, a dream project of mine, whereby I'm able to direct so much of that creativity into creating something that has long kind of been there in my mind. If that makes any sense, just yeah, if there's like just a world of my own, essentially, that to working with modern Doom mapping and editing tools has enabled.
Has it more or less been realized in the way that you first envisioned it, or bend it? I suppose it's your brother, because he originally, I think, came up with the concept way back when. How much has it really changed in concept? Did you have over the last 3.5-4 years, perhaps, since that initial put out in 2013, has it really steered in direction, or is it still that bubbly, colorful, paint-based, incredible total conversion that you were always hoping for?
I think, if I'm honest, it really hasn't changed to my original vision, and I think that says more about the mapping and designing team that I've accrued over, rather than my ability as a creative director. But certainly, it's turned out to be a lot of what I was aiming for, and much, much more. So I'm really just eternally grateful to my team for helping me out with it. With regards to the origins, I suppose, yes, the character is like essentially a desktop doodle that my brother did when he was in school. And there really wasn't much else to the character at that point. He created some little comic kind of things in Microsoft PowerPoint. I don't know if he ever plans on releasing those, but those are pretty much the genesis of the character. Back in those days, he had the ability to transform into like various things, like a boxing glove or like a big truck or something like that. So there was a lot of stuff that obviously didn't make it into the total conversion.
How did the boxing glove never make it? That's a genius. You know those retractable gloves on those sort of girder-like extensions. And yeah. Was that? Come on, yeah. That's genius.
Actually, now that I think about it, that was going to be a weapon it was one incarnation of the project where it was basically a rocket launcher that fired boxing gloves like that. That was going to be a weapon, but that was years and years ago now.
Maybe for the before the DLC, for the Mayweather DLC or something.
Yeah.
Always topical, since there was a boxing match last night that I didn't watch because boxing is dead. And of course you've been around the world with it as well. You went to, I think it was, wasn't PAX. PAX is the one in the US. What was the one in Germany that you met up with the other developers that I unfortunately couldn't attend?
It was in England. Me and my brother went to EGX in London.
I think I'm thinking of Amaze, aren't I? That's the one that Matt went to, right?
Yes, Amaze that happened in Germany. I think Matt and Jazz Mickle have been there twice now. Definitely twice to different countries to show the game off. And actually, I think Tantum went
Lucky
as well
bastards.
At some point too. I think a California Expo. Yeah, it was just heaps of fun. There was just so much to see and do there. It was a blast to do that, and a real adventure to just meet these people who've helped me out so much with this project for so long now. To meet them in the flesh, that was just an incredible thrill. And the game was received very warmly as well. It was there was usually a bum on the seat, essentially, playing the game, having a real blast with it, and it was really rewarding to see people from all walks of life, people of all ages, having fun playing the game. And that was just like, I think the first episode. Yeah, it would have been the first episode because it was 2015.
I think it's coming at a very good time with the indie resurgence. Mm-hmm. No doubt you would have discussed this to death with someone like M-Trop, who really knows his name in the scenes as well. I think he spotted a few people up there and was happy to get into lengthy discussions with. I have no idea who they are, but he's very keen, and so that's always good to see. And I think people. Yes, because Doom is topical at the moment with the release of the latest title back in May last year. But generally speaking, that core gameplay and simplicity to it, I think is going to be attractive to both veterans who are now with Doom becoming topical again. They'll see the roots in a game like that, and then they'll go back to it. And also the new kids on the block who are always attracted to colors and flashy things. So I think you really struck something there.
Interestingly, I did sneakily promote the game on John Romero's new Discord.
Bold.
And got a little bit of feedback from it. Romero actually really liked the website, which was not my doing. That was the doing of Mtrop and Zazer, who did a fantastic job with the website. But yeah, official thumbs up from the man himself there, which is pretty good to witness. And someone else asked me on that channel as well whether their 10-year-old son could play it. And I said, well, yes, pretty much, because, you know, the violence is paint-based and it's not, like, particularly graphic. I mean, you have little eyeballs floating everywhere, but what kid doesn't like that kind of stuff? It's all... Yeah. It's innocent and cartoony, and you know, it
brings a smile to your face. Yeah. I know. I think it's Ed Cripps. He's been having his son play it, and I think he's 3 or 4 years old. And I mean, that's just amazing. Mm. That must bring a warm feeling.
It really is just wonderful to see. Yeah, all these little kids and really enjoying this thing that I've.
And I hope you told them to play on play on the lowest difficulty settings, because Square is. It's hard, man. It's really
hard. It's pretty punishing. Especially the cubular difficulty, which is very much for FPS paragons only as the difficulty, as it warns you. I think Ed's son actually was playing on God mode, but that to me, that's fine, because you know everybody plays on God mode as a kid. They're playing games.
I mean, I used to play on God mode until my dad came into the room and said, "There's you know." Eating is bad, and then he took Doom away from me, and I didn't see it for another 13 years. Oh, boy. Yeah, that was a thing.
Which is, yeah.
Best of luck with Adventures of Square. I'm really, really looking forward to the second episode coming out, because I want to see what the bloody hell you've done with my level, for starters. But back before I departed.
I think so far, one of the top levels for me in the new episode, actually. Caesar and Tarnsman and maybe Mtrop, like, all contributed to that, and they did it in, like, just fantastic ways. So I think you'll be happy with that.
Amazing. We've got a couple of questions from the community. I mean, Dobu, Gabby, Maru. It's not because they don't love you. They all love you. It's just Doom Radio.
I hope so.
So perhaps you've already answered this question in part, but... do you find it more difficult to make music or maps for Doom, and are they equally hard to apply creativity for? Which do you struggle with more?
That's a very good question. Thanks for that, Dobu. Mapping might be just the one I find just a slightly bit more quote-unquote difficult, purely because there's just a lot of options. There's just heaps of stuff that you can do with the Doom engine now, so many formats to choose from. Lots of custom textures and content, and you know, all the stuff on Realm 667 is just mind-boggling what people have been able to do. I would probably say that mapping is just it's more complex a process to get through. I think maybe because you have to have a very specific idea in mind for what you're going with. With MIDI music for Doom. It's like you were saying earlier, it very much reflects the content that's coming out of the community at the moment, whereby you can really, it's a lot of MIDI composition you can get away with quite safely.
Especially in Deathmatch.
Especially in Deathmatch, with how just rich the content that the community is putting out is becoming recently.
I would certainly call Lady Gaga rich, yes. I suppose the second part of his question is quite interesting to me, and I think I'll just reiterate it. How is it equally difficult to apply creativity for either one? Which I suppose what he means by that is that you have an idea in your mind and it's easier to realize in one than it is in the other. So one for one, does an idea come out easier in music or in mapping?
Definitely easier for music, I would say. I think with mapping, you can make quite a bit of mistakes, if that makes any sense. There's a lot of ways that you can shape a room or shape an encounter gameplay wise. And some of it might not, gel immediately well in the mind. Certainly that applies to a certain extent in composing music. But I might say that if you have a knowledge of music theory and all that kind of ways to fall back on when you're composing a piece of music and it's not quite working out, there are a set of rules and, I wouldn't say rules, but just general guidelines that you can fall back on just in case, you need to lift your music up just a little bit, which I've certainly done before. And obviously it's very, very easy to ingest a piece of music, if that makes any sense, to actually absorb what's going on in it.
It's a lot easier to pinpoint where something goes right or wrong when you're working in the sort of limitations that MIDI has to offer. I wonder if that the same would be the case if you expanded beyond MIDI, started doing more complicated compositions in different formats. Mm. Have you had much experience in working with
digital audio? Quite a bit. It's something I'm slowly kind of doing more of. Certainly with collaborations and projects at university, I'm definitely getting more involved with that. And even on the actual theoretical side of it as well. So I'm actually printing out sheet music for my music as well, and giving it to musicians to play live, as I did with my end of year recital last year, which was a massive, massive undertaking. And I'm probably going to have to do another one at the end of this year. So
presumably you don't give them the piano rolls, though.
No, that is an option. That is an option. They do allow you to do that at the EWA Academy.
You're not still working with Sibelius, are you? On campus?
Yes.
Oh yes, wow. Jesus, that thing doesn't die, does it?
It really doesn't, no. I mean, there's other programs like MuseScore. There's a ton of it out there, but I think Sibelius is pretty much the general standard that everybody uses, so it's a little bit foolhardy not to use it, if anything.
Well, just to plead ignorance on that part then. second question by Dobber, and I'm going to bank the answer to this one as square, but maybe you'll surprise me. Did you have a dream project you wanted to undertake when you first became interested in modding for Doom?
When I first became interested in modding for Doom, I suppose it would have been square in a lot of respects. But on a kind of solo side, I suppose, I also wanted to create a one-man Megaware.
Oh, everyone's dream, yeah.
I do confess to that. So, yeah, I think that basically boils it down, though. It was one of those two. But Square certainly has been, I think, a dream project from the very get-go. The other side of things, I eventually realized in Genesis, but as you mentioned earlier, I did start out with the Skulltag community and creating maps in that. So it was very much Skulltag that got me back, like seriously back into Doom, because I was suddenly aware, oh wow, you can just load up a game and there are bots to kill and it's like Quake 3 and it's amazing. And I'm like, this blew my mind as a kid. So I think that's when I got very seriously involved with the forums at that point. And
did you join the ZDoom forums first or Doomworld?
It was actually the Skulltag forums I joined first, and then ZDoom, and then Doomworld. I think I eased myself back into the kind of classical side of the community quite a bit after I was initially exposed to what people were doing behind the scenes, in the multiplayer and the ZDoom communities.
Well, it looks like we've reached the end of our interview here. It's been, I think, a very productive one. So thank you very much, James, for... Wow, I just called you that. That's unusual. How's that for formality? For reappearing once again. And everyone, keep your ears peeled. That's possible to do. Actually, don't do that. That sounds painful. But keep them something for Intermission E1M9, which is the secret podcast. I don't know if you need to have some... I don't know, browser trickery to access it. I think it'll just come up on the airwaves, to be honest, which is a bit disappointing. Not really secret. of course, that's Terminus and his crew with Intermission. And thank you very much for tuning in once again to Doom Radio. This has been me, Alfonso, talking with James Papik.